And we've learned that Charlie Kirk shot dead. And he was talking at the university campus. A lot of people there discussing and talking about many issues, social issues, political issues. And what has happened in the aftermath of what is this catastrophe was everybody was taking benefit from what has happened. And some were Israelis, those people who were supporting Israel said because he was supporting Israel, he was killed. Right, left, and what's your take? What's your understanding of this? Do we have right and left anymore? Is there anything there to separate people by? I don't see that. I don't see right and left. I don't see that in Europe. I don't see that in this country that I live in Brazil. I don't see that in the United States. I think it's so simple-minded to talk to somehow judge people based on right and left. It's much deeper than that. What's your take on that?
Well, I've thought for a very long time that left and right was a false dichotomy for a very long time because, you know, I grew up in the communist world. In former Yugoslavia, under the one party communist government, and in school we had to study Marxism, and you know, then I went to the West when I was 17, and you know, the rest of my education was very much capitalistic kind, and I studied economics in university, and then you know, I became an oil trader, and then I became a hedge fund manager. So I'm not a, you know, how do you say it? I'm not partial to these ideological divides, but I also, the more you understand the actual issues at hand, the more you realize that they're completely false. You know, people in the West think that they live in the capitalistic world, that places like Venezuela, like China, like former Soviet Union, you know, Eastern countries, that they were socialist system. Actually, the systems were exactly the same. They were based on exactly the same monetary system. The differences were mainly about the division of, let's say the nature of government spending. So in the systems that we call socialists, government spends bottom up, meaning the money is distributed to welfare programs, let's say more generous pensions plans, more generous healthcare, education, and things like this. Whereas in what we call capitalistic system, the government spending goes top down, meaning it's going to big corporations, primarily to the big banks. Military-industrial complex, big ag, big pharma, and so forth. They're all very, very heavily subsidized by the government, and nobody complains about it because if the money goes already to the wealthy, let's call it corporate types and bondholders, then everybody thinks that's fantastic. That's, you know, that's how things should be. But basically, that is the difference, and I think that the whole left-right divide is just an ideological construct to keep people distracted by arguing the wrong issues. And so I've noticed now that a lot of people reacted to the killing of Charlie Kirk as though this is leftist violence. It has nothing to do with leftist anything. The conflict, it always, you know, this is very important to keep in mind, and you and I have discussed this more than once. The conflict is between two systems of governance. And those two systems of governance are the oligarchic Western colonialist approach, which is always directed at building an empire of colonies around the world. And then the other side is pretty much the rest of humanity, both, you know, countries like Russia, China, Iran, Brazil, South Africa, and so forth, but also the domestic populations, because, you know, if the domestic populations are not not friendly to this oligarchic system of government, which is prevalent, particularly in Western Europe, in the old colonialist nations like France and Britain primarily, but then also Holland, Germany, and some others, then this system cracks down on their own populations as well, which, you know, we see everywhere around. You know, we've just had very violent clashes between French protesters and French police, which is a regular recurrence. We saw the same in France. The AfD party, which is not friendly to the globalist system, they just had 14 of their candidates in one region die suddenly in the space of 2 weeks, which is, you know, statistically almost impossible. We've had in France the opposition of Assemblée Nationale, led by Marine Le Pen. Basically, she was forbidden by French courts from participating in presidential elections. We had assassination attempt against Robert Fico. We had disqualification of Carin Georgescu in Romania, and so on and so on. And what do all these people have in common? They are interested in their nation's sovereignty. They want to regain their nation's sovereignty. And in that, they are in opposition to the globalist system of these Western European oligarchies, which are also present, by the way, in other places like Japan, the United States, and so on. You know, they have their satellites all over the place. Wall Street is one of the most powerful satellites of this oligarchic system, which is always, by the way, based rooted in the money lending oligarchies. It's not just any old kind of oligarchies. It's particularly the money lenders, the banking cartel, the too big to fail banks, people who control them. This is not, you know, this is hidden. So, you know, sometimes people will say, like, well, why don't you name names? Well, I don't know what the names are, because these names are kept hidden, and not even U.S. Congress can get those names to know who exactly they're dealing with. But we know that, you know, certain families turn up all the time, like the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Mellons, Fairchilds, and so on and so forth. So we know a little bit about it, but it's all vague and foggy. But this is the opposition, you know. It's the oligarchies of the Western European and powers and the United States opposed to everybody else, not just other nations like Russia and China, but also anybody who opposes them, even domestically. And so I think that Charlie Kirk was an important opinion leader, an important activist and influencer in the United States, who was supporting Trump, whose activism was again in the direction of returning the United States to its Republican roots, protecting the American sovereignty, not selling it out to the globalists. And so he ended up getting killed. There's nothing to do with him being to the right of center and then getting killed by those who are to the left of center. It has everything to do with him being, implicitly opposed to the globalist system of governance. And then, you know, who exactly killed him? We don't know, but allegedly he was himself worried about the Israelis killing him, even though for a very long time he was a staunch defender and supporter of Israel, even into this genocide. But then also he was on the assassination list in Ukraine, I think, Mirotvorets or something like that. he was on their list. And, you know, from commentary that I see online, a lot of people are saying, no, this was absolutely not a disgruntled leftist. This was a professional, well-planned, well-coordinated hit job. And so I wouldn't waste energy blaming the leftists. It's a different problem that we're facing.
Here is part of what he said on podcast, PBD podcast, Patrick Ben David podcast about Israel, Alex.
The whole country is a fortress. When I first heard this story, I still had the same gut instinct that I did initially. I find this very hard to believe. I've been to that Gaza border. You cannot go 10 feet without running into a 19-year-old with an AR-15 or an automatic machine gun that is an IDF soldier. Right, the whole country is surveilled. And so let me just kind of go through this. We don't talk about Israeli politics very often, and most Americans don't know this. The last 9 months, Israel was on the brink of civil war. It's not an exaggeration. This judicial stuff, there were hundreds of thousands of Israelis taking to the streets because Bibi Netanyahu was basically redefining the Israeli constitution. That's not an exaggeration, right? He said the judicial branch has too much power. There were protests planned this week against Netanyahu, where they anticipated tens of thousands of people to take to the streets. That's all gone, Patrick. Netanyahu now has an emergency government and a mandate to lead. I'm not willing to say, to go so far that saying that Netanyahu knew or there was intelligence here, but I think some questions need to be asked. Was there a stand down order? Was there a stand down order? 6 hours? I don't believe it. Israel's the size of New Jersey. When I took a helicopter ride from Jerusalem to the Gaza border, it's 45 minutes. Wow. 6 hours. They're live streaming the killing of Jews. Did somebody in the government say stand down? That is a legitimate non-conspiracy question. The whole country is the IDF. The whole country is.
Yeah.
And you're trying to tell me that they're going to concerts and kibbutzes and schools and by report.
Yeah. These are the same sort of arguments that you've been doing here on this podcast, Alex. It's not that much different from us and what we're talking about. And
yes, exactly. Only Charlie Kirk had a much, much wider following. He was an American. He was close to, his turning point USA was very close to Donald Trump. I think that they galvanized a lot of American public opinion towards supporting Donald Trump. So maybe he, at least in the United States, he was a much more consequential player. And then, you know, he started as a staunch supporter of Israel, which means that he probably got very good reception, very good acceptance by pro-Israeli cohort in the United States. So to see him turn and start doubting could lead a lot of these Israeli supporters to turn and start doubting as well. So because you and I are maybe on the same sides for a long time. I mean, I thought this was a false flag operation from day one, because I know a little bit about that Gaza border. I have a friend who used to be part of the IDF, their intelligence, and who worked exactly on the Gaza border. And this person told me 100% this was a false flag attack. There is no chance that this could possibly happen. I was there. I worked on this border. Not a chance. And then, you know, if you paid attention, there have been, I found another 7 testimonials by former IDF soldiers, commanders who were familiar with that border and who said the same thing. There's not a chance in hell that this was not a false flag, that there was a stand down. And I think that in the meantime, even somebody came out to say, to confirm, no, we had a stand down order. And so that's clear. But, you know, Charlie Kirk is a different class of person. You know, he was a true believer who started to lose faith. And so a lot of true believers pay attention to him. So if he starts to lose faith, then they start wondering, let's think about this. And then, you know, the broad-based support for Israel in the United States could start to crumble. So who knows? You know, I don't know. The Ukrainians had him on their hit list as well. But then, you know, it's once you understand this perspective that it's a conflict between the, you know, the rules-based global order, this oligarchic system of governance, and everybody else, then you understand that the conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in Israel are two battlegrounds of the same war. And so it's not a surprise that the government in Kiev and the government in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, would be equally irritated by Charlie Kirk and want him dead.
Alex, just coming back, because as we talk about Charlie Kirk, there is a lot of people discussing what's going on and this right and left mindset. Today in Europe, let's assume that when it comes to Macron, Starmer, Merz, can we say who are these people? They're left, they're right. There is nothing there. Why should we go after these sort of arguments, discussions that we do? We know that we are wasting our time.
Well, yeah, you see, I just mentioned the governments in Kiev and in Jerusalem, and they're not leftists, they're fascists. And then if you look at the governments in Berlin, in Paris, in London, they also are fascists. You have in Berlin, you have Friedrich Merz, who is the former CEO of BlackRock Germany, right? And then you have in Paris, in the Elysee Palace, you have Emmanuel Macron, who is a former Rothschild banker. And then in Britain, you have Keir Starmer, who is not a former banker, but he is a lawyer. And then he's the minion of Tony Blair. Tony Blair is the great eminence, the eminence grise behind Starmer government and the man who actually pulls the strings. And Tony Blair is a fixture of the City of London, which is, you know, the global banking cartel headquarters, right? And then, you know, after he did his premiership, after he retired from being the Prime Minister of Great Britain, he got a £5 million a year job at JP Morgan as an advisor. I don't know what he advised them for, but he did deliver them the war in Iraq with his, sexed up dossier about Saddam Hussein being able to nuke London in 45 minutes. You know, that was Tony Blair. And I think that he was the leader, you know, he was tasked with delivering that war. George Bush and his government, they appear to have been in charge, but I'm not convinced. Tony Blair was very, very deeply involved, and they had very close tie. The special relationship. You don't know exactly how it works, but we know that they have extremely close ties, or they did have until Trump came on the scene. With all the governments, with George W. Bush, Obama, Clinton, and Biden.
Alex, we had Israel attacking Qatar, and this was somehow game-changing for the Middle East, for the geopolitics of the Middle East, with what's going on there. And it's not Syria, it's not Bashar Assad, it's not Lebanon, Hezbollah, it's not Yemen. It's the one of the most important allies of the United States in the Middle East. And they attacked, they failed to assassinate the leaders of Hamas. And here is what Netanyahu said. And we had the Israeli ambassador to the United States suggesting that they're going to continue with this assassination mission. But here is what Netanyahu said.
They should applaud Israel for standing and up to these same principles and carrying them out. And I say to Qatar and all nations who harbor terrorists, you either expel them or you bring them to justice. Because if you don't, we will.
Yeah. It seems that they're not backing down. They're going to attack again and again until they can assassinate these people. What is, when it comes to attacking Qatar and I think the gravity of what has happened is huge for the region. You're taking that. How can we understand that? How do you see the consequences of this sort of act for the United States, in my opinion, primarily?
Well, you know, first of all, thank you very much for having me listen to Benjamin Netanyahu. Nima, you always ambush me with something like that. But, you know, the man's hypocrisy is just absolutely off the charts, because Benjamin Netanyahu is the godfather of Hamas. He has, in fact, coordinated with Qatar for the funding, and he has pressured Qatar to continue funding Hamas, even when the Qataris were actually had cold feet and didn't want to continue funding Hamas. So now he's there fulminating against Qataris for harboring terrorists. That's exactly the organization that you brought to life, Mr. Netanyahu, and you insisted on continuing to fund them. For what reason? To preempt the formation of the Palestinian state. So he wanted to fund a group that they wanted to turn into, you know, jihadi fanatics, or they predicated them as such. You know, they wanted such a group in order to say, well, you know, there's nobody to negotiate with, and then to make sure that the Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank didn't talk to each other, that they were on hostile terms to each other. But, you know, regarding Qatar, one thing that is, for I don't know what reason exactly, is consistently overlooked in the Western mainstream media, is that Qatar is a very close friend and ally to the British foreign policy establishment and the British government. Qatar has two air bases that it uses in Britain, where Qatari aircraft pilots are trained by the RAF pilots. I think that Qatar is pretty much the only country in the world that has two military bases available to them in England, okay, in Britain, sorry. And they are very close, they very closely cooperate in terms of sharing intelligence. And Qatar has been, you know, the home base for this part of Hamas leadership that didn't really live in Gaza. They lived in Doha, in a lap of luxury. People like Khaled Messal, Ismail Haniyeh, and the like, you know, they traveled around on private jets, spent time in five-star resorts. They didn't share the lot of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And when the attack happened on Tuesday in Qatar, my initial gut feeling was that this was an attack on Trump. And, you know, my first question is, who benefits from this? And it's not Trump. You know, as much as people like to hate Trump, this was potentially a fatal blow to Trump's credibility, because this was not the first time he fell into this trap. In July, Trump administration was negotiating with the Iranians, and then the Israelis attacked Iranian negotiators and killed a bunch of them. So this was the second time he fell into the exact same trap. Anyway, you know, as I was wondering about that, then came out the news that there was a British Royal Air Force surveillance aircraft that was circling Doha for hours at the time when the attacks happened. And then we also saw that Trump was very embarrassed. He was saying, "I'm not very happy about this." And then he called the Qataris, and you know, he made a statement about what he said. Maybe that is what he said to them, but basically the gist of it was that this will never happen again, and that they will sign a new military cooperation agreement with Qatar. And then almost immediately after that, Netanyahu comes out and he says, "No, we will do this again." So they exactly contradict Trump in this sense and challenge him, undermining his credibility. So there's that's a huge problem. But for some reason, you know, the role of the British is never scrutinized. It always ends up passing under the radar, and you know, all the commentary and all the vitriol ends up directed at the Americans, and now, you know, particularly Trump. I think we need to look a lot closer at what the Brits are doing. It was their surveillance plane that was flying over Doha, in the very same way that British Royal Air Force surveillance plane fly over Gaza almost every day. And we know that they share intelligence with the IDF in real time. Presumably, they're providing them targeting intelligence so that the Israelis know where to drop the bombs. And so, to my mind, that could be exactly the same reason why the Royal Air Force plane was flying over Doha on Tuesday. So, you know, people unloaded on Trump. In part, he deserved this because he didn't play this very well. But I think that the British role has to be scrutinized a lot more closely.
I think that was we can say that they attack, and it was in the news that they left the room, the negotiations room, were praying, and they went to pray, and that's why they left behind their cell phones that Israeli attacked them. But in my opinion, that was a huge intelligence work in Qatar, and who's behind that? It's the biggest question. There's some rumors that the Turkish intelligence was somehow managed to inform them before it happened. But it was the final minute, the final moments of the attack. That's why they couldn't manage all of this evacuation from the scene.
Yeah, correct. Apparently, it was the Turkish MIT who informed the Hamas delegation or the Qataris that the attack was coming at the last moment, so they were able to avoid it and survive. I don't understand why Trump and his people tried to own this and to say that, oh yeah, we, you know, well, it was Netanyahu who said that the Americans gave a green light to the attack. And then Trump said, like, well, we informed Qatari ahead of the time. But as it turned out, they informed the Qataris 10 minutes after the attack had already happened, which means that they didn't know either. You know, they were taken by surprise, meaning they got ambushed by, I presume, by the Israelis and the British. And it potentially destroys Trump's credibility, because who will now negotiate anything with the Americans, with his administration? You're putting your life at risk if you negotiate with them. And even if Trump is not doing it, even if it's not Trump or Hegseth or Marco Rubio and or Witkoff, but maybe their administration is so infiltrated by spies and informants that they can't, you know, they can't even negotiate anything with anybody without the Brits or the Israelis knowing about it. Then that's a massive problem for them to address. But you know, we'll see what happens, because I think that the Qataris will have no alternative, no option but to try to patch up with the Americans. I think that maybe they will have to rethink their relationship with the British, because, you know, like, if I know that the British aircraft was overflying Doha at the time of the attacks, then they know it. The Russians know it. The Americans know it now. The Hamas people know it. I think that, you know, the silver lining in the event is that it has shed some light at who is the peace arsonist in the region. And, you know, that the top of the list to my mind is always the British foreign policy establishment. I want to make sure to underscore that it's the British government, not the British people, because, you know, as people become more and more aware of the British role, we have to understand that also the British people are being kept in the dark about this and lied to and propagandized, because, you know, the conflict between the two systems of governance is not just against foreign nations, but it's also against your own population. And, you know, now we see social uprisings kind of gather momentum in the UK as people start realizing what is being done to them as well.